Welcome. I'm Sarah White, a retired director of pharmacy who has a continued interest in effective pharmacy leadership. The purpose of this conversation with a successful pharmacy leader is to hear, in his own words, aspects of his career. Our purpose is to glean tips for current and future practitioners, because leadership is quite different than being a good pharmacist. By way of a brief introduction of my guest today, Max Ray, he has held a number of different leadership positions, or in my terms, has done it all. He worked as a staff pharmacist, hospital pharmacy director, college professor, College of Pharmacy clinical division director or chair, ASHP staff member, California Society of Hospital Pharmacists executive vice president, and College of Pharmacy dean. We are fortunate to have Max with us today to share his observations on leadership. Let's benefit from your experience and discuss career planning. When you started your career, did you really plan on all of the various positions that you've held?
Oh, no. I don't think that I would have ever predicted half of the things that I wound up doing in my career. And I think, although this is a cliche these days, I think the best I could say about that is that we prepare ourselves for opportunities by simply doing the best that we can do in whatever position we have, certainly getting to know people in the profession, perhaps publishing a few papers to share our thinking and the results of research that we've done with others. That leads to offers that you might not have expected. So I couldn't say that I had planned the career that I had. It was in large measure a series of accidents, I suppose, but it's been a wonderful career, and I've enjoyed every part of it.
So what advice do you give to younger people today about career planning or thinking about their careers?
Well, I can tell you it's much different today than it was when I started out, and if there are any of my younger former residents or students who see this interview, who recall that I might have engaged them in good discussion about what are your life plans, what are your 5-year and your 10-year goals. And I think that was all with good intention, and it was really to stimulate a few thoughts about what do you want to do. But today, as I think back on that, I'm not sure that I would do that again. I think my advice would be prepare yourself for whatever opportunities might arise and be open to considering opportunities that might be new to you that you hadn't given any thought to previously. It's going to take you in some exciting new directions.
As you think back over your career, who are the people that influenced you and how did they influence you?
Well, we all stand on the shoulders of giants. There's no question about that. And there were a few in my own life. I'm reluctant to start naming names because, you know, inevitably you leave out some important ones. But I will say that there were three individuals that I'm going to mention that influenced my professional life significantly. One was Grover Bowles. Grover was my professor of hospital pharmacy when I was a graduate student and resident back in the early 60s, University of Tennessee, and residency at Methodist Hospital. Grover took a personal interest in me, as he did with all of the students who were there at the time. And he was someone that I called to discuss directions that I was considering, and he always gave me good advice. The other two people that I'm going to mention are people that I never worked directly with, but I got to know, and through a lot of conversation and by being influenced by the things they had written, steered my course. One is Paul Parker. The first time I met Paul was when I was a resident and I arranged to go up to Kentucky, University of Kentucky, where Paul was the director of pharmacy. There were things going on at Kentucky that I knew about, had read about, had heard about at ASHP meetings, and so I just thought it would be important, since it wasn't that far from Memphis to Lexington, to take a drive up there and visit. So I arranged that, and I was expecting to go and learn a little bit about their unit dose program, their drug information center, and some of the early models they were thinking about for clinical education and practice. And I accomplished all of that, but what I wasn't expecting was to come away with a new friendship, a deep friendship with this man, Parker, that continued for the rest of his life. And I still think of him fondly today with a special appreciation for all of the things that he did for me. Now, I wasn't unique. This was just Paul. He took an interest in a lot of people in pharmacy, his own residents, his own students, but a lot of other people in the profession. So later on, as it turns out, and we'll probably talk a little more about this later in the hour perhaps, but when I became the director of the residency accreditation program at ASHP, the Director of Accreditation Services, during that entire time, Paul was involved as a member of either the Commission on Credentialing or just as a volunteer surveyor. So we worked a lot on the road together for a period of 10 years. And on every one of those occasions, we had some of the most incredible conversations, discussions. And Paul was never one to engage in a lot of idle chatter. He was serious. He wanted to know, what are you thinking? What could we do to change this profession? Where should we set our sights for 5 or 10 years down the road? Mm-hmm. And every time I saw him, or every time he called me, or every email I got from him, he was challenging. Okay, what are you thinking about today? So he had a wonderful influence on my life. The third man, and these were all men, Dr. Don Brody. Brody was a true visionary. I refer back to his paper even today, which was the subject of his 1980 Whitney lecture on the theoretical basis for pharmacy practice. Now, that's a title that causes most people's eyes to glaze over, but if you read it and think about it, it really helps us understand what our purpose is in life. And I look for opportunities to involve students and residents today in a discussion of Dr. Brody's Whitney paper. Those are three of the mm-hmm. giants. What did they do for me? They picked me up when I fell down. They gave me good advice. They encouraged me. They challenged me. They made pharmacy come alive for me.
What do you do to try to mentor people? Because these were really mentors for you in our current terminology, I think.
You know, I don't recall ever having a discussion with either of those individuals where the word mentor came up. I think it's the sort of thing that happens without your having to give a lot of thought to it. I think mentoring does really involve two levels. One is that sort of informal experience that occurs when some younger person is watching you, and maybe you're not even aware that that's happening. You're doing your best job, and that's at some level is enough to have some effect on younger people. I have heard some of my former residents and students say that Max Ray was my mentor. Well, I appreciate hearing that, but I don't think it's something that I ever thought about. We never really had that sort of discussion. Now, there is another second level of mentorship, and I have had some experience in this as well, and that's when it's a planned kind of activity where there is a sort of a mentor-protege relationship. And I have had students and residents who have asked me about being a mentor. In those cases, I've sat down with them to explore, well, what does this mean? What are you willing to invest? What would you like to get from me? Mm-hmm. What this usually leads to is sort of an agreement or a compact mm-hmm. with each other where I tell them, I'm going to be checking in with you periodically. We're going to sit down and have discussions about progress you've made, where you are in your thinking, where you're headed. And I usually say to them, and there are no right or wrong answers, but we're going to think about it together. And I'm going to do my best, since you've come to me and asked me to play this role, to channel you and prod you and to encourage you. And just, I want you to know that I'm looking over your shoulder. So I think they're both levels of mentorship, and I hope that I've been able to play both roles in my career.
Max, if you're at a meeting and a young person comes up to you, young people frequently tell me that they're sort of intimidated to come up to an icon such as yourself. Tell me how you view that.
First of all, it makes me shudder to think that I'm an icon, but I've had this experience occasionally, but and so it'd be difficult to know how many times there might have been some reticence for someone who recognizes me or knows about me to come up. But what I will say is that I do welcome that. I think any of us who've been in pharmacy as long as I have, and almost, you're not far behind me, I think, welcome that. Number one, it's a bit flattering, I suppose. But second, it's an opportunity to have a conversation that otherwise would be missed, that might plant a seed or two, that might provide some encouragement to that younger person. So yes, I think most of us who've made a career in pharmacy find that to be something that we welcome. So if there's anyone watching this interview who has any reticence about that, I'd like to just say, whoever it is that you see at a meeting that you want to talk to, just make the point to go up to them, and I'd be very surprised if they didn't take time to sit down and talk.
Yeah, and I agree. It is a compliment that somebody is interested in our opinions.
Sure.
So they shouldn't be reticent.
Exactly.
What are some lessons that you wish you had learned earlier rather than later in your career?
Oh, that's a good one. You know, I think it took me a while to learn the lesson that there is more than one solution to most problems. I suppose this is characteristic of young people, those who are perhaps have some streak of idealism in them. And I think back to my own early years, and I think that probably accurately describes who I was. I know that I was pretty rigid in my thinking. There is the right answer to this problem or this question. And I've come to learn that that is very seldom the case, that there are many paths to take. And more importantly, I've learned that you're going to come up with better solutions if you involve others and listen carefully. And I think I might have been more effective if I had learned that lesson a little earlier in life. A second lesson, and I think it sort of is tied to the first here, is that I'm not sure I recognized early on that people are motivated by different things. You know, I tended to see the world, I think, in terms of what motivated me, but obviously that's not the same sort of incentivizers that would work for other people. So I think I eventually did get there and learned that, but it took a while, and I wish that I had learned that earlier. I think I might have been much more effective in my first decade or two of my career.
As you think about some of the toughest or situations or obstacles that you had to encounter in having such a successful career, how did you deal with those situations that everybody encounters?
Well, of course, and I'll just use as one example, and there are a lot of pharmacy managers who have had to deal with this, and that is the issue of budget reductions and downsizing or right-sizing or whatever other euphemism might have been used at the time. Difficult issues, because it involves, in some cases, it involves dismantling programs that you spent years building. It involves the prospect of severing ties, working relationships with people who you view as close colleagues. There were times, particularly during the decade of the 90s when I and many other pharmacy managers dealt with those kinds of problems. There's no easy answer to that one. I think, as I look back on it now, the strategy was to minimize the harm that came from that, immediately began to strategize for, okay, how do we recover? How do we get back to where we were? What sort of new relationships need to be built? What new arguments need to be presented to those who make budget decisions? To not just let that completely pull the rug out from under you. I remember a quote from the Czech poet Rainer Maria Rilke that has meant a lot to me. In an exchange of letters he was having with a young protege, the question came up, how do we deal with the real tough problems in life? And Rilke's advice was, well, you come to love the problem and live the problem. And eventually you will live your life into the solution to the problem. Now, on a day-to-day basis, it's easy to forget that, but I try periodically to step back and think about that. And the problems that you dread and you want to avoid and you try to find a way around, at some level you embrace it. Put your arms around it, say, you're my problem. I'm going to work with it. I'm going to incorporate this problem into who I am. I'm going to deal with it with every ounce of energy I have, and trust that an answer will come. I believe that that does happen.
You've had leadership roles in very different settings. What would you say the major, I guess, leadership responsibility was, say, when you were a director of pharmacy, and then we'll work through each of the aspects of your career?
Well, any director of pharmacy, I expect, would view his or her major responsibility as working with a good team of people to provide good outcomes for their patients, good drug therapy outcomes, and a safe system for the handling and control of drugs. So I tried to get up and go to work every morning with that thought in mind. My job today is to organize a department made up of individuals who have specialized roles. Each member of the team has a unique role to play. See if we can get this group to work together to achieve the best possible outcomes for our patients. And a hospital pharmacy department has its own rhythm, its own pace, which is different from other kinds of organizations I've been a part of. But I would just add, it's where my roots are. It was my first love. My first job out of pharmacy school was as a staff pharmacist, and that was before going into a hospital pharmacy residency. So whatever else I've done in my life was predicated on my hospital pharmacy roots.
Okay, let's talk a little bit about the leadership role of a College of Pharmacy division chair. I think you were chair of basically clinical pharmacy at MUSC.
Right, I was the first person at MUSC in that role. This was at a time when the whole concept of clinical pharmacy was beginning to take shape. The ACPE requirements for clinical education had just been adopted. We had a few clinical practice models that were already out there, and I happened to be in a school then where we were trying to get up to that level. The first responsibility I had, and I had the good fortune to have a supportive dean who not only understood where I was trying to go, but was encouraging it. Going out and recruiting good faculty. And in those early years, that was a bit of a challenge because we hadn't really produced that many good clinical pharmacy practitioners yet, or those with academic skills. But I got some good people in, and we built the program together. We based it on our own ideas about the outcome objectives we wanted to achieve with the courses that our division was responsible for. And it was a great experience. Now, a department chair or division chair in this instance is a different rhythm than hospital pharmacy. You know, in the hospital we have patients who are there for 3 to 5 days, and we have to do our best in that case. Now, getting into the academic center, the focus of your activity there is not a patient but a student, obviously. A different rhythm, a different cycle, a semester rather than 3 days, or an academic year, a 4-year period of study, those sorts of landmarks. And you think differently, you organize your thoughts differently. But what I will say is that each position I've had in my career was all aimed at improving the profession. It wasn't really for any other purpose. I focused, or tried to focus along with our faculty at MUSC, on building a curriculum that would prepare practitioners who could go out and blaze new trails.
Then leadership as a staff person for professional organizations. You worked both for ASHP and then were the state exec for the California Society of Health System Pharmacists. So what are the leadership roles as a professional organization staff person?
Okay, at the staff level, and at ASHP, we were organized at that time into, we used to use the term bureau, then it became divisions and maybe a couple of other terms along the way. So our work was organized according to function, and I was in the professional affairs area, and that included the residency accreditation program. It also included our first foray into specialization in pharmacy. We used to have the SIGs, the special interest groups, which you'll recall. We had a research unit, which Michael Stolar headed up, and a couple of liaison responsibilities to other national organizations, such as the American Nurses Association, American Hospital Association, the Veterans Administration. The work of someone in a professional organization involves pulling together the thinking of groups of members, committees, councils, commissions, taking the work of those groups and organizing it into some sort of written output that can be used to feed into the policy process of the organization. Since that is the job, you're there every day thinking about it, working on these things, gives you an opportunity to exert whatever your own background might lead you to think into this process, always with the thought that, you know, it's going to be reviewed by and filtered through layers of the membership. It was one of the most exciting periods of my life to be on the staff at ASHP. It led me into experiences that I don't think I would have had through any other kind of experience. Now, switching from that to being the CEO of a state organization, quite a different level of responsibility there. We were focused, or I was personally focused, more on a legislative and regulatory agenda. I had to give thought to, as the exec of a state organization, who does what best? In other words, what should I leave to ASHP to do? On the other hand, what should I leave to the local or regional chapters to do? But what is best done by a state organization? Really came down to a couple of things, making sure that the CE needs for the members in that state were met, but more importantly, providing leadership in the policy arena with the state board, with the legislature, and then forming and growing the relationships with the other professional organizations. This was a whole new experience for me, but what it what appealed to me about it was, once again, on this theme of using a position to try to grow and influence and develop pharmacy practice. For example, we were successful working, I would add, closely with the California Pharmacists Association. We did work closely together. We were able to get some things to the state legislature in California, which I think maybe were perhaps the models for many other states, and collaborative practice, a number of other things that we by now are beginning to take more or less for granted. As mundane as it sounds, we also spent a lot of time on the technician issue, and you know, there are still states that try to hold to certain numbers or ratios on the number of technicians that a pharmacy department can use. And so we believed that pharmacists in hospitals in California could be a lot more effective if we had more technical support, and we fought pretty hard for that, and we made some progress in that area.
So leadership as a dean of a school of pharmacy, what's that all about?
A different kind of animal altogether. First of all, academic units or colleges, universities are predicated on such concepts as self-governance, academic freedom. Those terms are used a lot. Because of the nature of colleges, we have a lot of highly specialized individuals. Faculty members tend to be very specialized. Sometimes it's difficult to get shared, let's say, consensus or a shared vision of where you want to take a unit that's made up of such a disparate group of individuals. So there's a challenge. Now, it's not an insurmountable challenge, and I had the good fortune of working with excellent people in the several colleges where I've been. I was only dean in one, but I think in every institution that I've been associated with, one characteristic was very good people who want to do the right thing. But keeping the members of different departments sort of working together, recognizing, you know, that they each come from a variety of different backgrounds, those with PhD degrees in some very highly specialized areas of pharmaceutical sciences, biomedical science, to the other end where we have clinical faculty who came from advanced residencies and fellowships, who are highly specialized, for example, in critical care or pediatrics oncology. These groups don't always speak the same language, and it takes some working together, a lot of talking to each other to build a common understanding about what kind of product we're trying to produce from the program. And you know what I found is that if you can get the whole group rallied around a set of outcome objectives, terminal competencies, and then get them to talking about how their individual course relates to that, suddenly you've got people talking to each other. I found that it was helpful, for example, to get members of, let's say, the basic science group and the clinical group together and working on one course together as sort of co-facilitators or co-course directors. That got to a different level of conversation. So I would say that the real challenge for a dean, apart from the routine things of resource management and so forth, is to help build the relations among faculty, great people, but who are products of their own backgrounds, working together, sharing the vision for the kind of practitioner you want to produce.
Since you've had leadership positions both in hospitals and in colleges, are the cultures within those organizations different? And if so, what is culture and where does it come from?
Well, quite different, begin there. Going back to what I said earlier, you know, in the hospital setting, we're focused on patients who are there for a short time. Now, a different story in the ambulatory clinic where you might see patients once a month as they come back for repeat visits. But so depending on where in the hospital or health system you work, you know, there's its own rhythm that's driven by the patients, acute care, ambulatory care. And everything that you do in that setting is organized around providing care to that patient. So there is a culture in that setting of caregiving, caring, of being focused on doing the best you can within a relatively short period of time where things are changing moment to moment. Real-time decisions are being made. In a college, again, the calendar is different, the rhythm is different. We tend to think more about a semester or an academic year, or in some instances, you think about the four-year PharmD curriculum and where students are in that, but it's all oriented around an academic calendar. The student is the focus. And with that comes a different type of culture. It's a culture that's driven by the need to be a good teacher, a good researcher, contributing to scholarship. And it's also driven by the fact that the reward system in a college is unique. It's different from any other kind of organization. Promotion, and in the case where tenure applies, promotion and tenure, is unique to the academic world. And so there are cultures, is a culture, let's say, that grows up around that. I would add that I think it's probably, also there's a unique culture that develops in professional schools and even in a pharmacy school compared to an undergraduate liberal arts program, although I have less experience in that area to draw on other than having been a student as an undergraduate early on. But I think the short answer to your question is that there are major differences in culture, major differences in mission, and they're both exciting.
You've been a faculty member, right, for the majority of your career. Right. Talk a little bit about what a clinical or practice faculty member's role is, how to be successful in that role, what did you enjoy, some of those things.
I would say that the overarching purpose in a pharmacy school faculty member, the role of a faculty member, is to make pharmacy come alive for the student, to help them understand what role they're being prepared for, to help them avoid falling into the pitfall of thinking that what they previously thought about pharmacy before they came to pharmacy school was sort of the endpoint. To expand their thinking, to expand their horizon, to create desire to be helpful to patients. And these are big challenges, you know, because each student varies in their orientation, in their propensity to be a good caregiver, in their interest. But I would say that the single most important job of a clinical faculty member or pharmacy practice faculty member, perhaps of any faculty member in the College of Pharmacy, is to engender that service orientation, that feeling of professional pride, but also professional responsibility and accountability in students. That is the job as I see it.
What about the need to publish and the time it takes to do that?
Well, two parts to that, I think. One is, you know, there at some level we should be motivated to share opinions, commentaries, also the results of scholarship, of research, because in the academic world, part of the mission is to generate new knowledge or to stimulate thought in different directions. Now, because of the rules in academia, that's more or less a requirement. And so in order to get promotion or tenure, there is the expectation, you know, that faculty members are productive in the area of scholarship. But I would say that, you know, to the extent that it can be done without those pressures, without those forces, that really can be a very satisfying experience. We've both had that kind of experience. You know, once you get a paper finished and it's been accepted by the editors, it's a good feeling.
In 1997, you received the prestigious Harvey A. K. Whitney Lecture Award, which is the highest award in health system pharmacy. How did you feel about that recognition?
Well, Sarah, you know how I felt because you've had the same experience. And what I will say is, first of all, when I got a call that I had been selected in 97 for the Whitney Award, my first thought was, I must have broken in line. Because I thought, you know, there's so many people ahead of me in that line who deserved it that I was a little bit incredulous. Now, after that thought dissipated, I guess what settled in then was a feeling of incredible honor. It is, as you say, in our field, in the field of health system pharmacy, recognizes the top award. So to have the validation of your peers, to be honored by the whole profession in this way was just an incredible highlight of my professional life. So what else could I say? It was, you know, just a supreme honor.
Your lecture was entitled Letters from the Edge. Mm-hmm. Could you talk a little bit about it? It was kind of a unique approach. Talk a little bit about what you said and what the essence of your message is.
I was thinking that it would be helpful if we had sort of a past, present, and future look at pharmacy, and I wasn't trying to limit it necessarily to health system pharmacy, but to the profession in general. I was interested at that time, and I continue to be interested today, in what do we mean when we use the term a professional practice? I was really interested in the idea of a practice. And I found myself trying to look back, say, 50 years to the thinking that might have been prevalent in the profession at that time, only for the sake of sort of then reflecting on, well, have we done? To get at that, I thought it would be interesting if somehow we had someone from outside the profession who was intelligent, recognized as perhaps as a philosopher, make some comments. So I imagined what I thought Alfred North Whitehead might say. So I created this dialogue in a letter that he was writing to me as the recipient of this year's award, from the grave, as it were. So in that dialogue, I tried to get from this person from the past some reflections on what his observations were. And although he was able to determine or identify a few positive things that were pharmacists were doing, he was also asking questions, but I didn't see you really taking responsibility for drug therapy. I wasn't really seeing you do much except dispense a product. And so he was asking tough questions, which I thought maybe we should begin thinking about. Then I brought it up to the current time, to, as you mentioned, 1997. And I wanted, again, to have a detached view of where we were. And so I never used C. Everett Koop's name in the paper, but from the way it was described, you could sort of identify that that's who I had in mind. So I had this former Surgeon General who was very much wired into the healthcare scene at that moment. To take a look at pharmacy, and he too was asking some tough questions. This was all by way of sort of helping us think about then where should we be headed. So I then called on someone from the future to kind of report back to 1997. Okay, how did it all turn out? And what I imagined was happening I guess that would put it at 2047 if it were literally 50 years later, was not really a linear extension of where we were, and there were some changes that I had imagined would have occurred. One being that because of technology, particularly information technology, the boundaries around the professions as we know them had become blurred. And we had new categories of healthcare workers. What was common to all of them was automated information and decision support systems that were readily available. I imagined that we truly had a healthcare system wherein the premium was on keeping people well, and even looking at illness as perhaps a failure of the system, not really the focus of the system. Also, I imagined that care would be organized in a much different way by a level of acuity. A real focus on keeping people well, but those who ultimately needed treatment for disease got it in ways that were tailored to their level of acuity. A much greater emphasis on patients as the sort of the focus of their care, a patient-driven system. Now, how this pans out, you know, we can come back in another, 40 years down the road and discuss it. But I was trying in that Whitney address to think about the early, 50 years earlier, the way the stage had been set for where we were in 1997 and where that was going to take us. In each case, the technique that I used was an imaginary letter from someone to me so that I could sort of listen to what they were having to say. By the way, the letter from the 50 years hence was one of my, a member of the charter class from Western University where I was at the time, so.
When you were with the ASHP staff, you set up what is referred to as the Hilton Head Conference. Could you talk a little bit about, I think that was roughly 1985.
That's correct, yeah.
What your thinking was, what it was, what process was used, and its significance.
This was at a time when we were still discussing whether to move toward the PharmD program as the entry-level degree in pharmacy. There was a lot of pushback from a lot of quarters on that, and we never got around to making that conversion until 15 years later. During this time, there was also pressure building to recognize clinical pharmacy as a specialty. I had been at that time in the residency accreditation program at ASHP for 10 years, and as I had visited programs around the country, I began to see certain common elements in the way pharmacists were being trained in residency programs, which concerned me, and I expect they concerned others. The clinical role seemed to be to go on rounds, have physicians ask questions which you didn't know the answer to, and you'd said, I'll look it up and come back. Well, okay, and that got us into the clinical arena, but it didn't seem to me that we were progressing very far, very fast. A big part of the profession was nowhere near that level yet. And, I don't mean to zero in on any particular area of practice, but we really had not developed any real meaningful clinical roles yet in community pharmacy, where about 70% of our workforce was going. The question, I guess, on my mind was, is pharmacy in 1985 inherently clinical, or is clinical pharmacy something unique to a few people that have a PharmD degree or some other advanced training? We put together a plan for a consensus conference. It was invitational, but efforts were made to represent the leadership of the profession broadly, not just health system pharmacy, but the whole profession. We had educators, we had practitioners, we had association people, we had a couple of international observers at the conference. This was the meeting at which Doug Hepler gave his paper that became rather famous on the covenantal relationship between pharmacists and society. That's not the precise title, but that's what he talked about. what came out of that conference was a resounding affirmative answer that, yes, pharmacy is inherently clinical. And if we can't acknowledge that, then we are faced with the problem, okay, what is it? If clinical pharmacy is something special or is a specialty, then how do we define what's left? This was the first point at which thought leaders in the profession seemed to get their arms around this and agreed in the report, in the proceedings, that this is no longer on the table for discussion. We are going on record as saying that this profession that we spend our lives in and which we love is a clinical profession. And if we're those who aren't there yet should aspire to get there. Now, we spent a lot of time at that meeting also discussing the barriers. What are the things that hold us back, that are holding us back? What could we do to resolve those kinds of problems? And the proceedings really amounted to the keynote addresses and the results of these workshops where we looked at barriers and potential remedies. What I wasn't expecting was the way that report resonated with the profession. And for some years thereafter, we kept hearing reference to the Hilton Head Conference. Now, many younger members of the profession probably don't have any idea about what this was, but it came to be known simply as the Hilton Head Conference because it was held at Hilton Head Island in South Carolina. It led to a series of follow-up meetings at state and regional levels, so the torch continued to be carried for some time. I remember that after I went to California, you mentioned earlier in the interview that I had been the CEO for the California Society. One of the first things we did when I got there was to pick up on the Hilton Head wave that was washing across the country. We had our own mini Hilton Head there in California, and the results of that conference drove the agenda for our state chapter for several years. I think in my discussions with one of my good friends in this profession, Dr. Doug Hepler, that this led directly to his thinking about pharmaceutical care as sort of the focus for pharmacy practice, he together with Linda Strand. I think Doug had thought deeply about all of this in developing his presentation for Hilton Head. It was only 4 years later that he gave the now famous pharmaceutical care presentation at the second P21 conference. And so I believe that conference had major influence on the way things have unfolded since then.
The BPS, or Board of Pharmaceutical Specialties, has really been key to our development of clinical specialists within the profession. Since you've served on that group, could you talk a little bit about how it functions?
Sure. Well, I've been on one committee with BPS. First of all, I think BPS, or the Board of Pharmaceutical Specialties, has taken us to a new level in pharmacy. For those who may not know about it, it is a subsidiary of the American Pharmacists Association, but it has its own board and it's autonomous. It dates back to the mid-70s. It was acknowledged and supported by all of the national organizations that existed at that time. The purpose of the BPS was and is to identify areas of practice that can legitimately be viewed as specialty. So, and there's a fairly rigorous process that has to be met, those who are interested in gaining recognition have to go through. There has to be a demonstration of need. There has to be a demonstration that there is some mechanism by which one qualifies to be a specialist in that area. This leads then to a certification examination. The examinations are written with the assistance of national educational and testing specialists. They are tied directly to the task list or the jobs that are required in that area of practice. I would say that it is a rigorous process. At the moment, I don't remember how many specialties have been recognized, but it's a short list. There are others that are seeking or who are in discussion now about what they might need to do to gain recognition as a specialty. But we haven't gotten into the two-digit category yet. So we have five or six, I think, recognized specialties in pharmacy. I found it very interesting to be a part of that because it gave me an up-close and personal look at that process.
If you could sit down with current practitioners, what would you tell them about pharmacy?
I guess I would be led to share with them some of my hopes, my own dreams for the future. I would begin by saying I think we do need to have the courage and the wisdom to acknowledge the limitations that we're facing, not for the sake of being discouraging, but for the purpose of addressing the issues. We have a lot of growing and building to do in pharmacy to achieve our maximum contribution. We have about 235,000 pharmacists in the workforce. And I often think about what we could do if all of these people, or the largest majority of them, were really engaged in meaningful, personalized patient care. And I don't see any reason why we can't expect that we'll be there. So what would it take to get us there? I'd like to engage young pharmacists in that kind of conversation to get them to thinking about the big picture in pharmacy. I would hope to encourage young pharmacists to develop the habit of mind to think about the profession from that 35,000 foot view, recognizing that in order to be effective, you have to continue to come back down to ground level and, you know, sort of go back and forth a few times. Stay focused on where we are in the trenches, but also on a fairly regular basis. All right, step back, take the elevated view, the broad view. Where are we? What are the obstacles? What are the problems? I think so often about the observation tower at Gettysburg, the battlefield. You know, you can go there and you visit and go up to this observation tower and you can survey the whole environment. And if you remember enough of that history, you say, well, you know, if this regiment over here had just moved over here, or if this general over here could see what was coming, this thing might have been a lot different. Maybe some of the catastrophic loss that day would have been avoided. Well, that's what I'm talking about, having that observational platform. Now, this is strictly academic or imaginary because we don't have a physical platform, but I think we can develop the habit of mind of stepping back and asking the big questions periodically. All right, where are we going? What are the issues? Let's not cover them up. Let's not ignore them. Let's frankly acknowledge where we are, and just have a renewed sense of purpose.
What does pharmacy need from current and future leaders?
Leaders need to help us get from the theory of practice to the envisioned reality of practice. We have so many reports that have been written, the results of a lot of meetings, consensus development conferences. We have blue ribbon panel reports. We have white papers. We have a variety of things in pharmacy that represent good thinking, even the Hilton Head conference that we were talking about earlier. Leaders are needed to provide the transition. I think the job of a leader is to will the future into existence. And if we have people out there, even a few, who can do that, I think that would put us a lot further ahead.
As you think back over your career, what's brought you the most satisfaction?
A variety of things. I don't know if I could boil it down to just a short list, but I'll try. First, and I will acknowledge that I believe that I was in hospital pharmacy early on during some of the golden years when things were happening, and there were so many exciting things happening in the 60s and 70s in the earlier part of my career. it was great to be a part of that. And I'm talking about such things, you know, as building programs to improve safety, the unit dose program, IV admixture services, the early days of drug information centers, and then the whole clinical pharmacy movement, you know, the whole idea that pharmacists had something to do besides a responsibility for the drug product, but rather to the patient who took the drug. Being a part of the period when all of those concepts were evolving was a great excitement, and I don't believe I could have picked, if I had the opportunity to, a better time to have been in practice than when I started out. To the extent that I was ever a good clinician, I remember many occasions seeing direct results, individual patients who benefited from what I, Max Ray, did, and that gave me great pleasure. And I, every pharmacist has that experience, I expect, but preventing a tenfold or a hundredfold dosage error in a PEDS patient, and I've had those kinds of experiences. Again, most pharmacists, I'm sure, have. Those are things that you celebrate. You know, it gives you the feeling that, yes, this really is important. In the area of education, you know, I've been in pharmacy during the period when we went from a five-year BS to the PharmD, major change in curriculum during that time. The curriculum has gone from a product focus to a clinical or patient focused metamorphosis. I think being in education during that time was very satisfying. Although, as I mentioned earlier, a fairly large percent of our workforce go into areas where they may not be fully challenged. On the other hand, we still do have a lot of people coming out today who respond to the challenge and who are doing great things. And I have to stop periodically and just go back to the beginning and think about, where were we when I graduated from pharmacy school in 1962 to where we are today? And although sometimes the speed seems glacial, we've made a lot of progress, and I think, you know, I and others have to take encouragement from that. But I think, you know, we're just at a point where we could get to that next level. That's where leadership comes in. That's where creativity and education comes in. That's where residency training comes in. And my goodness, these are things to be it's fun to be a part of. You know, I think it's important that we talk a little bit about how a resident can take fullest advantage of the opportunity, because we have more people looking for residencies today than there are residency positions, and we try to pick the right people. We're investing, that is, program directors, preceptors, are investing an awful lot of their time and resources into training programs, so we want to make sure that we have make good choices in whom we bring in. Well, first of all, I think a resident should be a sponge. They should come every day prepared to learn, to soak up, to benefit from everything there that goes on in their environment. I think residents should be inquisitive. There are moments when there's nobody telling them what to do at this particular time. Residents should be encouraged at the beginning to seize upon learning opportunities whenever they arise. And if you have a down moment, have in mind something that you can go and investigate and check out. Make good use of that time. I would say also, and I think this is probably a difficult lesson for many residents, you ought to be willing to put in more than the minimum amount of time. I think there's a reason why we started to call these things residencies, because early on, especially in the case of medical residencies, you lived there. You lived in this site. You were there a lot of hours, literally a 24-hour cycle. Now, we're not advocating today working people to the point where they become error-prone or exhausted, but to be willing to be there where the action is, when it's occurring. I'm a great believer in night shifts. The hospital is a whole different world at night. The organizational structure is different. The people who run it are different, a different cast of characters. People begin to rely on each other a lot more in that particular environment than they might do during the day. In teaching hospitals, we have young house staff, residents, on duty at night who need a pharmacist perhaps more then than at any other time. So I think pharmacy residents ought to be in the hospital or in the training environment a lot of hours. So to the extent that a resident is willing to do that, I think they're going to get a lot more out of it. I think they should not be bashful about approaching their preceptor and picking their brain. They should seek feedback. It's not in the nature of a lot of preceptors or other pharmacists who may play a preceptorial role, such as clinical staff, to just spontaneously give feedback until it's time to do so. You know, at the end of a rotation, where you sit down with someone and sort of review how things went this month or this 5 weeks or 6 weeks. Residents should ask on a regular basis, how am I doing? Once the question is asked, the preceptor is going to respond and say, well, okay, since you ask, you know, here are the things that I think you're doing well, and here's some areas where you need to be paying attention. That can happen if the resident helps to set the stage for it. So I think dedication, inquisitiveness, just being willing to interrupt someone to ask questions, seek feedback, learn to build relations with the other members of the team, physicians, nurses, medical record librarians, dietitians, pharmacy technicians, everyone who's involved in that environment. And along the way also, depending on the administrative focus of the program, to learn to think how the administrative group in that facility thinks. So I think the short answer is dedication, being a sponge, being eager, not requiring someone to tell you what to do every moment, be a self-driver. I think those are some of the qualities.